You're listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
Welcome to the V3 Podcast with Dr. Ann Arvizu. Medical affairs innovators are changing the game for business success and making the world a better place for our patients. On the V3 Podcast, we showcase the vision, the voice, and the value of medical affairs. Each month, join host Dr. Ann Arvizu, a globally recognized medical affairs subject matter expert and awarded biotech industry executive veteran, for powerful interviews with today's acclaimed innovators and founders who are leading the profession forward into a new era. These high-level conversations will leave you inspired and equipped with future-focused ideas for changing culture and making an impact. And now, here's Ann.
Welcome back to the vision, the voice, and the value of medical affairs. This is the V3 Podcast, and this is the future of medical affairs. Once again, I'm your host, Ann Arvizu, and wherever you're calling in from today, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Listen up, because today it is my pleasure to focus and dedicate this special topical episode to patients around the world who are suffering with a rare disorder or rare disease. This V3 podcast in general is a passion project for me, just to help highlight the value that medical affairs brings to the pharma and biotech industry and help us to all bring the focus back to why we do what we do. Today is a special episode focused on rare disease, and I'm happy to introduce my guest today, who's an expert in this area. His name is Dan Donovan. He's a leader who I met, who I could just tell he sees a gap and moves towards it. When I met Dan last summer, we knew that we started to share the same heart when it comes to advancing diagnosis and treatment for rare disease through research, publications, and education, medical communications. So I think you're going to like hearing from him, as well as hearing a little bit about his career story as much as I do, because I resonate with it in so many ways. After getting his degree at Lehigh University, Dan entered the pharmaceutical industry. In pharma, he grew up, as we say, in the industry at Pfizer, which is kind of, you know, that catch-all phrase to say you've gained all your main sea leg years of experience on the business side. And he played a pivotal role in his time there in the commercialization of some of the pharmaceutical industry's most successful product launches. You learn so much in an industry career like this in pharma, and he did. And in 2001, he left to found Envision Pharma, and he served as its president until its successful acquisition by USB. And then Dan's immersion into the rare disease space began in 2011, when he was appointed to the board of directors and later as the chief business officer of CPP, or Cancer Prevention Pharmaceuticals. It was really through his involvement with CPP that Dan discovered how incredibly fractured rare disease communities tend to be, and he felt that there had to be a better way to help these communities who needed help the most. He's since, as founder of his second venture called Rare Life Solutions, created global communities that bring the multiple needed voices together. You can listen more towards the end of our conversation, and you'll hear a little bit more information about that. I want to start with asking if you've ever heard of Theodore Woodward. This is your kind of educational question of the day, right? Odds are you may not have. He was an American medical researcher in the field of medicine at University of Maryland, Baltimore. And in 1948, he received a nomination for the Nobel Prize for his role in finding cures for typhus and typhoid fever. But that's not what he's most known for. He is most known for a quote that he used when training medical students about how to diagnose. He said to his students, "When you hear hoofbeats, think of horses, not zebras." In his area, in the state he lived in, it was obviously good metaphorical general advice. If you're a doctor in Maryland and you're driving through the countryside, naturally you're going to see more horses than zebras on rural farms. He was trying to tell students to focus on the obvious solutions first. But flip that. The year is 2020, and in rapidly growing and advancing rare disease focused communities, the new version of that phrase is when you hear footprints, think zebras. It may be a rare disease. I'll get into some of the statistics when Dan and I speak, but in general, patients with rare disease go years and sometimes decades without receiving a proper diagnosis. And when they do, thanks to recently to genetics and genomics research, most of the time, statistically, there will be no treatment available for them. My local statistics in the U.S. also say that 1 in 10 Americans live with a rare disease, and over 30 million people are living with a serious or life-threatening, lifelong illness that may have little more than symptomatic care and might not truly work. So, February is Rare Disease Month. February 25th to 28th, 2020 is Rare Disease Week. And Rare Disease Day is February 29th, 2020. You can find more of what's going on in your country or your area at rarediseaseday.org. But I love that it's February 29th. It's in honor of this special leap year day, which only comes every 4 years. The day itself is rare. Tony Robbins' birthday is on February 29th. Can you imagine being a leap year baby? I think he turned 60 this year, and that means in leap years, he's like 15, I think. I'd have to do the calculation. I am doing this conversation and having this conversation today with Dan in honor of this special leap year day. And in this episode, we really hope to raise awareness and give medical affairs insiders and healthcare providers and anyone who listens to this episode some great tips and insights on how to keep making an impact and broadening our reach with rare disease, because we do have a lot of work that still needs to be done around the world. So join Dan and I in progress now. Hi, Dan. Welcome. So glad to reconnect with you today.
Well, thanks for having me in. I'm happy to do this.
Yeah, this is great. I think this is going to be an educational and fun solution about rare disease today, which I think you think like I do based on our previous conversations together, that we still have a lot of work to do in our industry in rare disease.
We are just scratching the surface.
Yeah, I agree. That's a great statement because, you know, years ago when rare disease started making its way into big pharma, and you'll know this too, we've both had long careers. You know, you bleed Pfizer blue. I have Glaxo orange in my blood, I think, from our very beginnings, and which actually started off as blue and teal. If you look at Smith Kline Beecham and Glaxo, and everybody knows the, you know, the old companies, but we have an industry that takes care of so many different therapeutic areas, and rare disease seemed to for a while become a buzzword, and therefore when something becomes a buzzword, it gets watered down. And you just said we're just scratching the surface. So if you're a healthcare professional, or if you're someone in medical affairs not really working with rare diseases, or you're skeptical about big pharma or small biotech starting up to just create these solutions that you think are overpriced, please listen up on this conversation. We're going to have a critical conversation about the patients in the middle of rare disease. So I want to set our conversation up, Dan, today by talking a little bit about rare disease for those listeners who maybe work in other therapeutic areas or don't know, or who are just generalists, right? We're both here located in the United States, and a rare disease is defined as a condition that affects fewer than 200,000 people. And that's part of a congressional act and actual definition in the Orphan Drug Act, right? That was finalized and ratified in 1983. So there has been this thing called rare disease for a long time. And rare diseases became known as orphan diseases. I remember back in GSK in my early years at Smith Kline Beecham, working on some clinical trials and having my first orphan disease given to me, or like trying to get access to an orphan indication for a particular therapy area. And drug companies have not been super interested, at least back then, in adopting to develop treatments. Why?
You know, until 1983, there wasn't a lot of incentive for drug companies or even academic centers to do research in rare because they didn't think they could sustain the development costs and commercialization costs of a drug that has a patient population that could be 100 or 1,000 or 30,000, because they thought about the typical commercialization model or development and commercialization model that costs so much to get a drug to market and then charge a couple dollars a day. It wasn't sustainable for 1,000 patients or 20,000 patients. It took some really brave pharmaceutical companies, you know, the Alexions of the world, to say, hey, we really want to do this research, but if we do, we're going to have to charge a fair amount of money for this so we can then continue to do research in these rare diseases.
Yes.
And, you know, so that was part of it.
That's a huge part of it. And it makes it, you know, you touched on something, is that it's a small amount of patients, right? So we have the U.S. definition that affects fewer than 200,000 people that could be determined as a rare disease or a rare disorder. And in the European Union or the EU, it's a disease that's defined as rare when it affects fewer than 1 in 2,000 people. So, you know, you're looking around, and then let's extrapolate that out to the rest of the globe, because we do global clinical research, right? And in Latin America, the numbers might be even smaller, and in China. But the diseases are actually more prevalent in some of the non-first world nations, right? They are, and they happen in two or three, or kids are shunned because of the way they walk, or kids are kept out of school because of a certain genetic disorder, or even from a, sadly, you know, from a religious standpoint, people would think, oh, that you know, that family or that kid or that person is, you know, maybe demonized or something. And it's like, oh my gosh, we have so much more to break through in science to help people.
Yeah, you know, it's sad, because if you look at the numbers, 50% of rare diseases affect children, and a third of those kids won't live to see their fifth birthday. So we're talking a real urgency, which is really what you're getting to there. There is an incredible urgency to help these people who need help the most, you know, the kids, the families. And so now with the 1980 Act, the FDA Act in 1983, which provided incentives, tax incentives, regulatory incentives to encourage companies to explore these diseases. We're just getting going.
Right. We really are. And, you know, one of the things that you can do within medical affairs, obviously this podcast, the V3 podcast, it's for the vision, the voice, and the value of medical affairs. I think one of the values that in general in medical affairs we bring to the table is being able to create either patient education programs, publications, communications, and also, you know, within the sort of umbrella of medical communications in general, creating patient ad boards, finding out what these patients and their parents are looking for, and getting activists involved, advocates involved, and the patients and the families themselves involved. So tell me what you think. What's your take on why are patients and patient centricity so critical in rare disease drug development and commercialization, and in what we do in medical affairs?
You know, it's so funny that we're now just asking ourselves that question. I mean, the very reason we research drug compounds for rare diseases is try to help these patients and their families. Yet it wasn't until recently that we said, hey, maybe we should include the patients in the process, other than as participants in a trial. Right. So prior to this, we really kind of used the patients, not deliberately or in a harmful way, mind you.
Right.
The intentions were good, but they were kind of a means to an end. Let's get a drug to market as fast as possible to help. The reality is patients and caregivers play so many roles in drug development and commercialization, and that role is magnified in rare. You know, they're researchers. They participate with the FDA to provide advice. So they're advisors to the FDA. They're community builders. They're the ones who bring like people in like circumstances together so they can learn from each other. They're educators. You know, they have to educate their physicians because they typically know more about this rare disease than their physicians do. Physicians typically learn about 400 diseases over the course of their training. There are 7,000 rare diseases. They also can't be expected to understand these rare diseases.
So
they have to be educators, not of just their physicians, but also the schools. You know, what happens if my son has a seizure? What do you need? What do you do? What can you feed my daughter? What's okay? What's not okay? So they're educators, right? And you mentioned patient focus panels. They're strategists. They can really help these companies develop the products in a smart way and in a rare sensitive way. So the roles they play are amazing.
They really are. And, you know, there are companies out there that really get that. There are larger companies and maybe big pharma that have rare disease now indications because it's part of the portfolio or there's an extension of something that makes it viable for them to be able to spend that money and you know, focus on that particular disease or disorder. However, now there's so much in genetics and gene therapy and smaller companies like Ultragenics or the Alnylams of the world, right? And they are really focused on very specific diseases and getting patients access into their trials in, you know, where there wouldn't be a way. People think of big pharma as or even little pharma or biotech as the enemy, right? It's the there's such a bad trust factor in our industry, but it doesn't have to be that way. When I want to shed a little bit of light is, guess what? There's some really good stuff going on too. So in your opinion, is that what you're seeing lately as well? Like, are you seeing pharma on board with this movement to engage and include patients? And do you see things moving in the right direction?
I do. And you know, when I started my current company, the role of patient advocacy in the pharmaceutical companies was only just emerging. There weren't a lot of them. And if there were, if that role did exist in a pharmaceutical company, they usually didn't have budgets. But over the last 3 years, it has really expanded. Now you have chiefs of patient relations, you know, a C-level role in these companies. And so companies are taking it very seriously. And I do think it's moving in the right direction.
Yes, I agree. One of my clients over the past couple of years, they have a chief patient officer, and that is so, it is so refreshing and it's so good. And you know, these patients and the parents of these patients, or, you know, you mentioned 50% are kids. That means the other 50% are adults. And some of these adults who are advocates for themselves in their own disease that has not, has been underdiagnosed or undiagnosed for so long and put them through so much, they become such advocates that they are just as, you know, I mean, I know that they're not a physician, right? Or a pharmacist, if you will, but they become major, major experts. And there are lots of places that if you happen to stumble upon this podcast because you see rare diseases and if you are a patient, there are wonderful resources out there for you. There's the Rare Diseases Clinical Research Network. There's Therapeutics for Rare and Neglected Diseases. There's the Rare Diseases Registry Program. There's the Genetic and Rare Diseases Information Center. There is the, you know, rare diseases. You can go to the NIH.gov where you can find a list of FDA-approved orphan drugs. There's just so much. There's other advocacy groups like NORD, as you know. You know, what am I missing? Am I missing any?
There's NORD. There's the WODC, and of course there's Global Genes. I mean, these just 3-4 years ago, they were smallish events. They are growing by leaps and bounds. So there's real interest in rare in a lot of different ways from the FDA. From the patient perspective, the caregiver perspective, so the interest is really growing, and it's only just getting started because of those 7,000 rare diseases that you mentioned, there are only about 450 drugs that are approved.
Right. take that in for a minute, you know, listener, take that in for a minute. It's a huge gap.
Huge. The good news is there are 1,200 companies researching 1,900 rare diseases right now.
Mm-hmm.
But even with, let's take that in for a second. So let's just say by some amazing stretch of the imagination that all 1,900 drugs get approved. That's still like a third of the rare diseases that are out there.
Right.
Right. So even with all of that research going on, we have a long, long, long way to go.
Right. A lot of times it is the patient first that comes and says, I need you to figure this out. I need this to be diagnosed. And they start making their voices heard until they get help. And that's a lot of, you know, because it's not on people's radar. It's like what you don't know, you don't know. So how do you go looking for what you don't know? And it's like the needle in the haystack. The needle is pushing itself up to the top of the haystack and saying, look at me right here. Here I am, you know. So that is great. And like you said, these meetings are happening. So, and now Rare Disease has a day, February 29th, 2020. Mm-hmm. We'll be, you know, at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., there's Rare Disease Day. So there's a rare community survey going out there. There's Impact Awards happening in Cleveland, Ohio this year. There's the Breakthrough Summit of Rare Disease and Orphan Products in Washington, D.C. So bringing some of these interesting new meetings, which is sort of outside the wheelhouse of pharma, to light is interesting. And I love that that's where we met. We met at the Rare Disease Forum 2019, which I had the privilege of being asked to chair and co-chair. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you and I got a chance to both speak at different aspects of medical publications. And so we both have some expertise in this, but you definitely have some expertise. In fact, you're a little bit of an inventor, aren't you? Like, you created DataVision. So if you don't know what DataVision is, if you're in medical publications, you know that that's a open source reporting tool that you can use for publications, and it gives you transparency to the end-to-end process of publications like other tools out there. And that's part of Envision Pharma, all these tools that we use. I want to ask you and tap into your expertise now on publications. How do they differ for rare disease? What would you tell a medical publications group if you can give them a few tips on what to do internally? What would you say?
Yeah, you know, I just gave a presentation. I just participated, chaired a conference this week. It's the first time ever on medical publications in rare diseases, because it is different. Like everything in rare, it is different. Mm-hmm. You know, some examples of things that we really are big proponents of are things like open access. It seems simple, but not everybody publishes in open access. And if you're a patient or you're a parent of a child that has a rare disease, your world's been turned upside down. And what do? You go to Google and you start searching and you find an article you want to read, but it's hitting behind a paywall. And you got to pay $100 or $120 to get to that article. That can be rate limiting, and it is frustrating. So if you're in rare, and I know that Shire's policy requires, obviously they do a lot of research in rare. They require their publications to be published in open access journals. I think that's wonderful. I think everybody should do that. It's slowly, very slowly going in that direction. Another example of something that's very different and rare that we are big proponents of is including the patients and advocates and caregivers as authors on the papers. Mm-hmm. We called a couple journal editors and we said, hey, what do you think about this? They loved it. So as long as they are meeting the ICMJE criteria, there is no reason why they shouldn't be authors on these papers. And they can give a really personal, intimate, and different perspective that a physician writing an article can't.
Right.
So those are just a couple of examples. I've got half a dozen more.
Oh,
but I don't
I love
think
it.
We have that much time on this podcast.
I love it. I would love if you have a patient example. Do you have any of those just in your box of...
That's a great one.
Yeah, you do? Okay, let's know.
Yeah.
Let's
hear it. So we're working on a manuscript now, and it's in a rare disease, but the the rare disease medical literature database has virtually nothing from the patient's perspective. So what we did, and you know, you also don't have a lot of natural history information. You don't understand the patient journey. It's just not in the literature.
Right.
We sat down with a patient in a rare disease, and we pulled together the life journey of a patient with this rare disease, not just the misdiagnoses, then proper diagnoses, then treatments and surgeries, but we looked at the psychosocial elements of the disease.
Right.
Because it changes from that time you're diagnosed to what you have to go through and the depressions and elations and all these different emotions that mm-hmm. these people have to go through and the impact and the guilt on the family, all these different things. Mm-hmm. But then we also added in that, you know, this woman has to see about 10 doctors a year, sometimes multiple times a year. So if you think about the implication of that, from downtime at work, the cost implication, the insurance implications, holy cow. So we laid this whole journey out on a big spreadsheet. And then we got in touch with some real physician experts in the field and said, we'd love you to be authors on this review article we're developing. And we shared that journey. And one of the experts said, oh my gosh, I have never seen anything like this before. And this is his field of expertise, to lay it all out like that in a single picture.
Right.
And then the other guy who we had anticipated would be the primary author on the paper, he said, I should not be the primary author on the paper. Mm. It should be this young woman.
Aww.
And she was elated.
Elated.
So
yeah.
We're developing that. Yeah. So we're developing that review article now.
Fantastic. That's truly a very patient-centric example of getting the patient's voice heard, not just put into your program, but heard. How do you think, you know, this has been kind of a little bit of a million-dollar question. People think, and when anytime the patient-centricity conversation comes up, and you know, people will talk about it at conferences, it'll come up like at networking events, and then people somehow drop it. They really go to the fact that yes, we want to put them in. Yes, we want to get them, you know, get their voice in sooner. But sometimes when you're sitting there working in a company, in the four walls, at your desk, in an office, and you're working on this plan, unless you're going out to find the patient, it's sort of a foreign concept, and it becomes lip service to people maybe lower down on the team, when technically every one of these companies out there has the goal of saying the patient is the center of all we do. Patient centricity shouldn't be a lip service term. How can companies, what advice would you give companies to ensure patient centricity happens?
I think, first we'll speak to some of the challenges that they have, right? Pharmaceutical company, it's a highly regulated industry. Mm-hmm. And anything that can suggest that they're doing direct-to-patient pre-approval promotion, they're scared. So because those fines that come along with that kind of thing are outrageous. I mean, they're substantial. So they're very scared. The second part of it is, this is not the typical block and tackle stuff that need to be done to get a product to market. It's about changing. And historically, pharmaceutical companies have sort of been like turning the Titanic, right?
Right.
They know they've got to turn, but it takes a while to get that big ship to move. They're getting mm-hmm. there. So they are starting to turn. And what I would say is, you know, the FDA is making that move. They're having patient listening meetings to invite patients to share their experience. They have the PFDD meetings, patient-focused drug development meetings, to gain patient perspective on their diseases and their journeys, their treatments, their life experiences. They've modified the NDA submission documents to allow for patient experience data. So the movement is there. It is a little bit slow going, but I think it's really picking up steam. And, you know, I had the opportunity. I was lucky to be invited to an emerging rare disease company, patient advisory board meeting recently, and they invited about 30 patients with this rare disease. And at the end, it was, you know, there were tears because the community was so happy that somebody was showing interest in them, that rather than the company thanking the patients were thanking the company.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was an amazing experience, and I was just so happy to see it.
That's great. That I love that. And I love that you care to be focused on rare disease. In fact, that's the name of your company, right? Rare Life Solutions. So where can we find out more about what you do? And why don't you tell us just a bit about your main focus and your main mission?
Okay. Rare Life Solutions is a rare disease focused health technology and scientific communications company. We inject everything we do with the PAC, the patients, advocates, and caregivers, because we believe they're the new shapers in rare. So we build digital, educational, rare disease communities, one community at a time. So we've got a sickle cell community, a Duchenne community, an amyloidosis community, a Graves community, a familial adenomatous polyposis community. And the idea is to bring everybody together, because we all need each other.
Right.
And to provide a place for communities to connect, to get trusted information, and to find out if there are any trials that they might be able to participate in. So it's sort of a one-stop shop solution for rare disease communities.
Yeah, it's a big
goal. And then we also do the scientific communication. So we work with companies to build these patient advisory boards, and we do rare disease specific medical publications. So it's part of our philosophy around the three things that matter in rare are science, community, and access.
Right. I think that's
where we focus.
That's really terrific, Dan. It's interesting because from a medical affairs perspective, I've had the privilege of having oversight to multiple functions within medical affairs. I've handled global medical information, medical communications at regional levels and beyond, and you know, multiple countries and in outside like of the big companies as well. Our focus right now for the small biotech companies is interesting because a lot of companies going to their first launch, what I see is that when they have something that's rare coming to market, they are maybe understaffing their teams internally. I've brought up this patient conversation and this rare patient conversation to clients of mine that I say, you know, MSLs, do you see the patient at the center of what you do? Do you understand the patient journey? You mentioned the patient journey before. There are companies that when they're just putting their very first medical affairs plan together, they don't even understand patient journeys or mapping and how to put that together and how to create that. When I brought that to the table for some, you know, someone who was a total KOL before coming into the industry, they were like, wow, this is really good. You know, because you have to see the big picture. You have to put the collaboration of science and technology together, as well as bring the patient voice in and bring all the people to the table. So I think that, you know, is a great message for us to end on today. Do you have any final thoughts or advice for medical affairs professionals working with rare disease?
We're all in this together, and there is a heightened need to work with this community in rare. They need pharma. Pharma needs them. We have to work with payers. Everybody needs to be on the same page here, so we can move forward faster and get to cures faster.
Yes, and you know, I would also just add that pharma's not the bad guy. You know, if someone's logging on to this podcast, there's a lot of very trustable people that care within pharma, physicians, PhDs, nurses, pharmacists that really do want the very best for patients, really do want at the highest level to have the patient at the center of what we do and bringing it together, opening up the conversation and being the change that you want to see within your own company is important. So if you don't hear about patient advocacy groups or haven't been invited to one, ask. Be the one that's maybe the manager or the senior manager or the director within your company to start to ask for where is the patient and connect to the cause that's higher than you. So Dan Donovan, thank you so much. We're going to, all the links that we mentioned today, we'll post them below. And Dan, have an amazing weekend. Thank you so much for
all
your
right,
time
thank
today.
You, Ann.
Take care.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the V3 Podcast, part of the ACMA Podcast Series, in collaboration with the Pharmacy Podcast Network. For all of the ACMA podcasts, please go to acmapodcast.com.